From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
It's a little embarrassing when you find out you're the most approachable host in America and you have another host right here who's clearly not as approachable.
No, I thought about that on the introduction. I thought, accurate. Rarely does a self-brag turn out accurate. You are the most approachable. Yeah, that's a great word.
There's
Who came up with that?
I think it was a team of marketers. But that is Will Cain, by the way.
Yes. What's up?
Well, it was good to see you.
Good to see you.
I know. I would say approachable in a way that could be an insult. Like,
Already. You want to be alpha. You want to be intimidating.
You want to have a little bit of an air about you. You don't see any air.
Like, that guy. There's no swagger. Afraid to go up to that guy at all.
Well, Will Cain, a little bit. I mean, tall. I mean, a lot of times you're not wearing a shirt. I mean, so you don't even know. So, Will, good to see you in studio.
Good to see you, man.
And you're usually going to be on the other side today for your podcast, right?
Yeah, I will be here in about, 3 hours.
3 hours. Fresh off a vacation.
Live on YouTube, live on Facebook. Yeah, I took a week off, went to Mexico, spring break. Right. I hadn't done spring break, like really done spring break, probably since college. This was that kind of spring break.
So you mean parents hung out with the kids?
Senior spring break. So I have a senior in high school.
Right.
Yeah. You seem to know. Have you done this? Parents did hang out with the kids.
No, like we don't. I don't think we ever did a high school spring break with parents. But you guys did that.
I was growing up either. It's a little more of a thing now. I'm not saying everybody does it, but it's a little. I hear other people say, "Oh yeah, we did that." Yeah.
Is it the age 18?
Yeah.
So
I don't really want to go into this any further.
But in other words, the kids can have a beer legally.
Yeah, they can have a beer or 880. a lot of questionable parenting decisions.
By you?
Like, for sure.
In retrospect.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know, man. I was watching Waters last night, and Kat Timpf was on, and they were doing some of this spring break stuff, and Kat was adamant, as was Jesse, kids need to start drinking again.
Yeah. You know,
because honestly, the threat is, look, everybody listening right now, I'm Gen X. You're what, a baby boomer?
Just missed.
You're Gen X too?
What is
65?
Right?
It's 65.
Oh no. So I guess I am technically a baby boomer. 64 is the cutoff.
Somewhere in there. So you're close.
Yeah. Where did Allison go, Eric? You just left?
She thought this would be a boring segment.
No, she went to get coffee.
So, our generations, this was the biggest risk, and they are risks. But like, I would say when you grew up, and I grew up, and you grew up around here, so Long Island, I think so, drinking and driving is the scariest thing, and you hope and pray and preach that your children don't do that, and of course, you still don't. But I'm talking about on the risk curve of potentialities, that is not that high anymore.
No.
Right? With Alto and Uber and all these different things they have, now it's like, don't ever, ever, ever take a pill, please. No matter what the pill is, don't take a Tic Tac.
One and done.
Whatever. Right. And the other risk is that you sit in your room playing video games and don't interact with people and you're anti-socialized. And so that's what Timpf and Waters were going on about last night, these kids on spring break. It's like, yes. And I've heard Scott Galloway, the guy who's kind of like into masculinity.
He said the same thing.
Go drink and make bad decisions. That's what they say, kids. And obviously we're not, anybody listen, I'm not certainly not advocating substance abuse. But the point is the kids are erring the other way.
Yeah.
They're erring the other way.
And they're getting depressed.
Yes.
They're depressed. They lose their confidence, a sense of purpose. And I know Scott Galloway has done a lot of that. In fact, he said it like 2 weeks ago, go out and have a beer. He doesn't mean get drunk, just go. But there's a socialness to it. Social drinking. There's a reason. People go to bars. They've been going to bars forever, saloons, whatever. But people have stopped doing that. There's this new app out that was in it. We were talking about today. You might even talk about it in your show at 4 o'clock today, Eastern. Dion.
And Dion, I saw it in your Frocks and Friends note. I still get the e-packet.
You still get the e-packet?
Please don't cut me off.
Well, we'll have to see.
I'm like a Fox and Friends alumni. For anyone listening, Fox and Friends has a great overview of the news that you get every morning.
And it's the first thing out.
It's the first thing out. It tells you kind of like every story.
By 3 a.m.
Big and small.
So Dion is an app where you can send a drink to somebody. So a little bit where this woman said, I wanted to send wine to my friend who was having dinner with a family for their birthday. And he said, it took forever. They took my credit card. And then I asked him to send it over. They charged me. The wine never got there. And he goes, I just got to come up with an app for this so you can order a drink to somebody. But now you have 20,000 faces. You go look over, you say, Will Kane, and let's say you're single. I'm going to send that guy a drink.
Am I in the same bar as this person?
No. Oh, not so necessarily,
like,
yeah.
From Dallas, I can send you one in New York type thing.
Right. I mean, it's more of a New York app, so they'll send you an espresso martini. Okay? So now all of a sudden...
Was that you got your drink?
No. I've never had a martini. I'm not old enough.
You never had a martini?
Never.
Oh.
Never had one.
You know, they sound fancy, you know, Bond.
And?
They're delightful.
They're delightful?
Yeah.
Here's my problem. I drink too fast.
Oh.
So that's why I'm better off with beer. So I have to know that that's why I would not, I don't really have hard liquor because I'm not really into getting drunk, but I would drink. I can't slow down my
Allison,
speed.
Have you ever seen Brian drunk? Come on.
I'm not sure I should answer that.
Of course you should.
We've never.
I've hung out with Brian, like what, Patriot Awards and other places.
Couple beers. Yeah.
Well, in a professional environment like that, absolutely not.
Yeah, I would never drink before getting on stage.
Nobody gave me that advice. No, I'm kidding.
All right, hey, did you keep up with everything when you were away?
No.
So you really dislodged.
I have the same bad habits of everybody else. I scrolled X. I saw a few, you know, whatever, online controversies here and there. But no, man, I did not read in every day.
Oh, I don't think I've ever not read in. Maybe a day.
Really?
Because I always feel, and you know, sure enough, every time you do, you miss a story.
Okay,
like,
but here's the deal. And I talked about this on my show yesterday. What do you think our news cycle is now? It's it's an old cliche, the 24-hour news cycle, because we don't live in a 24-hour news cycle. We live in a 6, maybe a 3-hour news cycle. Stories feel old definitely after 6 hours. And so that hamster wheel, what's the point in me keeping up on that? Like, if I'm on vacation and I step away,
mm-hmm.
The story that I missed on Tuesday doesn't matter by Wednesday morning.
Well, that's true with maybe a court case. The Guthrie situation will last a long time, but, you know, okay, you miss it, see how it comes out. It's easy to find out. But the war, for example.
For sure, yeah.
The war is really hard to miss a day of because you miss the nuances. The foreign minister speaks, the IRGC Navy commander gets killed, and then you think, what's going on with Karg Island? What's the balance of that? And then you go, well, what do you mean? Oh, the Marines are coming. I missed that. Mm-hmm. USS Tripoli heading that way. So for me personally, almost every time I feel like I pay the price when I totally disconnect.
Yeah, I but you and I have a different approach to this stuff as well. I mean, we really do. We've talked about this. Like, you know more details about stories than I do, right? And that sounds terrible for me to say. Like, for me.
But you think a big picture of what it means.
I try to think big picture and what it means a lot. And, you know, yesterday I talked about the war. Okay, what was one of the most helpful things for me is actually this negotiation between Iran, to the extent there is a negotiation, and we know the other negotiating party in Iran, is the U.S. laying out its demands. Because by laying out our demands, we get greater insight into our concrete objectives in this war. And I do think, as much as I trust, and in many cases love, and I mean that because I have relationships with many of the people involved in this administration, I do think the concrete objectives have been somewhat elusive. And by laying out our demands, I can see, okay, this is what we really, really have to get out of this war. The Iran side's pretty funny. I made the joke on my show yesterday. It's like Dr. Evil. $1 billion, right? One of their demands was no U.S. presence in the region. Got it. Cool.
Yeah, all right. That'll happen.
Bombs will keep dropping. When Hegseth says, like, we negotiate with bombs, I can't believe he got, like, blowback on that. Of course you negotiate with bombs. Everybody negotiates with bombs. Like, that's a tool. That's what we're trying to do. Effectuate an outcome, an end game. And that's a tool in the pursuit of your end game. And so my point is, when the United States says we want control of the Strait of Hormuz, we have to have no nuclear enrichment, no nuclear bombs, missile capacities, whatever, destroyed or diminished, you start to see really, really, really. And my question, it was Jim Hansen that was on my show yesterday, and this is something. How far along are we accomplishing those? Those five objectives without a deal. Like, how far are we along accomplishing those goals militarily?
And I think that we're beginning to put the stranglehold on with the arrival of the two Marine ships.
Well, okay.
And the other one would be the 82nd Airborne.
That is concerning. I mean, you and I, again, have different, I think, attitudes towards war. What I mean by that is I'm probably a little more skeptical and conservative. I don't mean like politically conservative. I mean like instinctually conservative towards the approach. The two elusive goals are ensure no nuclear enrichment and control the Strait of Hormuz. Those two goals are concerning in that we probably can't accomplish those two goals from 30,000 feet. And now you, to your point, the Tripoli's headed over, the Marines, the 82nd Airborne. So what is the goal there? Like, is that going to be take over what? The southern shorelines?
Or block. You don't necessarily have to go on to the island of Karg.
Well, Karg's the oil island way up in the Persian Gulf.
Right, but you don't necessarily, but you could do is block all access to it. So now all of a sudden the Iranians can't get to their oil. And then if they decide to, you destroy them. And you could also destroy all those fast ships in those areas. There's an island called QESH. I assume it's Kesh. And there's a few others to the point where the Iranians came out and said, if you do that, I'm going to block the Red Sea. But you probably don't block the Red Sea. You get the Houthis to do that. So far, the Houthis have stayed out of it. And after speaking to a high-ranking defense official, Secretary of War official, around that department, they said they think the Houthis got so pounded in 2025, they don't want to get involved because they lost so much. And they're not really considered satellite. They're not really, they're considered, you know, allies as opposed to depending on financing from Iran, unlike Hezbollah and Hamas. So my thing is, you got to get that straight open forever. This can't happen again.
For sure. And what kind of military control does that mean, basically on the southern shore of Iran? And what kind of, like, boots on the ground then? Because we'll destroy their missile capabilities, the boats. I think that stuff doesn't concern me in our ability to accomplish it. It's all the drones. And a drone could take off from anywhere, right? So how much do you have to control of Iran for there not to be drone kamikazes into a ship going through the strait?
Yeah, they only need one. You know, they want to do some damage, and people worry about insurance to get through there. But this is what you got to do. If you look back in the 80s, they do this. The 2022 is the last time. We're shutting down the strait. Shutting down the strait. Why? Another crisis is happening. We're shutting down the Strait of Hormuz. Well, already the Saudis have said, we're going to send 5 to 7 million barrels through the Red Sea. Okay? You have 15 total. What are you doing with the rest? Well, there is another pipeline that goes bypasses the Strait of Hormuz. So let's just say 2 million barrels. Sooner or later, you're not going to need it. That's one area. And the other thing is to have the world kick in and say, we're pushing everything back, including Germany. We're getting involved. The British said we're sending minesweepers in. So I believe at this point, well, we are seeing other people say the problem is not only because of this conflict. 2 years from now, we can't have the Strait of Hormuz controlling how much we're paying for oil.
For sure. And
that's got to be solved. And this group has to be cut down to size. This is a cancer that people tried to control the tumor, and this president said you can't control the tumor.
Brian, where do you think? I see the polling. I think there's brand new Fox News polling out today.
Yeah.
You know, MAGA supports this. Republicans support it to the tune of something like 70%. Man, the one that stuck out at me in there was independents.
Yeah.
28%.
So you got to show them success.
Well, so my question is, if that's accurate, that polling, and these objectives, specifically these last two, take a while. Like, what happens in November? And the price of oil stays high. So the price of oil stays high because the strait's not open, and this war kind of drags on, and independents already feel this way. I'm going to tell you something, Brian. I heard off camera the other day by somebody running.
Just to answer your question, it's March. If this is the story in September, game on. You're right.
Is it September? Listen,
No, it's not. It's going to end up wrapping up sometime in April.
No, I'm saying, do you have until September?
Oh, no,
you think it wraps up in April, by the way?
I think it wraps up in April.
I had a conversation with somebody running for Congress just 2 days ago, and he told me that his internal polling has flipped 5 to 6 points, up to down.
Right. That's what
he says, Republican. He says, because of this.
And that's, to me, does not surprise me. Because, number one, they were keeping oil prices low. They were beginning to control inflation. So they have the big, beautiful bill, the big returns that are about to come. And then all of a sudden this happens. And you ask yourself, are we just deciding on something? Like, for example, do we go ahead and poke the bear and get in and start a war that hasn't been brewing for 47 years? What he's saying is, I obliterated it in 2025. They're rebuilding it now. They're killing their own people and beginning to create havoc again with their proxies. So should I go handle it? Handle it in March and April, so everything gets back to normal. May, June, July, we'll get on the right trajectory.
So my thing is this: I don't see the world through a political lens. Like, oh my God, midterms, and you can pay the price politically for something you feel is right. My concern is probably my number one issue is immigration, and I'm today at 4 o'clock on the Will Cain Show. I'll have Congressman Andy Ogles on, who is pushing some what I think the popular world would call pretty radical ideas. I think they're pretty sensible ideas of revisiting the 1965 Immigration Act. Can he actually get it accomplished in those things? That's a very worthy conversation. But we have mishandled not only illegal immigration, we have mishandled legal immigration over the last half century in America. And as a result, we've paid a price. We had four terror attacks in 2 weeks in this country by naturalized American citizens.
Yep.
And so I don't think we're holding our standards up on what it means to become an American.
Or stay an American. Because obviously you commit a crime, you go into jail.
That dude went to jail for plotting with ISIS and still retained his American citizenship.
Yeah, got out for good behavior.
So if you lose the elections in the midterms, you lose all power and capability to really continue to pursue a real policy on immigration.
Exactly. So the big picture is... if it ends successfully, that strait reopens, that country is no longer a menace. The Gulf states continue to invest with us. I think things get on the right track, and the president gets the credit for attacking another long-term problem. The first one was Venezuela. This is the second. And Cuba's going to fall under its own weight, which will be unbelievable, especially for Florida.
You know, get some casinos back up and running in Florida.
Get the mob
Cuba.
Back. Get the mob back. Yes, that'll be good.
Send them back to.
I think that's the plan.
I don't think we have any Meyer Lansky. I don't know. I'm not really up to date on the Gambinos and the
My son's Lucchese. Big into the mob. I cannot believe it.
But I just don't know if they have any Meyer Lanskys anymore.
Right. Well, it's a shame.
That's when the mob was, at the top of their game.
We had someone to lean on, something to shoot for.
By the way, part of the reason that we instituted the 1924 immigration stuff when it got strict.
Which is?
Well, starting in 24, we got really strict and said we're going to have people come to this country from certain countries. We had quotas on who's going to integrate, who's going to assimilate, what's their likelihood of success. And a little bit of an influence on that was the rise of the Italian mafia. Mm. But I will say, in 65, they blew that out of the water. They just blew it out of the water.
Well, hell broke loose. Thanks, LBJ.
You know 70% is family reunification, family sponsorship?
Did I know that?
Chain migration.
See, look, don't say I'm a man of detail. You're the man of detail, Will King.
We both have our passions.
But we do have we do have to take a break. Unlike your format where you can just ramble on.
Yeah.
We'll listen to your podcast at noon.
At noon at YouTube, Spotify, Apple.
I'm going to watch you at 4.
Back
in a moment.
Fox News Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There are thousands of U.S. Marines on the way. What happens if they get used, do you think?
We defend.
What does that mean, though, for these Marines if they were to land in Clark Island?
Just read what happened in Vietnam.
Right. Saeed, something unpronounceable, to Sky News. He's the Iranian deputy foreign minister. You landed Clark Island, think Vietnam. Okay, fine. I'm pretty sure he doesn't know anything about Vietnam. But you believe me, if the Marines want Clark Island, they will take it. They already wiped out. Evidently, some people in CNN said they mined it. Okay. If the Marines want it, they can have it. The flip side is they become targets. You'll know exactly where U.S. forces are. Now you know where our bases are. You don't know the forces. But if you're on Clark Island, you could be a target. But these are the Marines. And this USS Tripoli, that will have assets on it. The other way to take Clark Island is to block it. Don't take it. You block it. And then somehow you just force that strait open forever and no longer give Iran control of it. They're holding the world hostage by oil.
Join Fox in supporting our troops. From daily needs to global emergencies, help us be there for those who serve. Visit go.fox/Red Cross to donate to service to the armed forces today.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Ms. McNeil, is America more or less safe because of this government shutdown?
We are really concerned about our security posture and what the long-term impacts of the shutdown is going to have on the workforce and our ability to carry out the mission.
The threat environment is too dynamic, sir, to allow this shutdown to continue on.
We are crippling our disaster response and recovery abilities by the day.
Yes, that is a little of the feedback that we're getting from TSA as they were forced to work without pay now and miss another paycheck. This is just absolutely incredible. And it looked like a deal was done on Monday. And then when Secretary Mullen was sworn in, I thought, okay, this is a chance to start fresh. Chris Sununu joins us now because the answer is no, they aren't. Airlines for America president and former New Hampshire governor. Governor, guess what? It's like every time you're in, there's another crisis. What's going on?
leave it to the federal government to ruin a good time. I mean, they were this close to getting a deal. And I think you're right. Mark Wayne Mullen's going to be a tremendous secretary of DHS.
Even though he was a plumber? Do you hear Jimmy Kimmel was mocking because he's a plumber?
Maybe you watched Jimmy Kimmel, not number one on my priority list. But no, it's nonsense. He's terrific. He's actually respected by Democrats on the other side. He knows the process. It's going to work great. They had a deal. It was right there. You know, and even Trump said, look, I don't really like this deal, but if it's what has to get done, you know, you guys do what you got to do. We'll fund TSA. We'll deal with ICE later. So the Republicans capitulated, right? That's what deal making is. They went back and the Democrats, oh no, we want some more. We want all the policy stuff too. And so they're negotiating it literally right now.
Because they're not going to go home. They cannot.
They're not going to go home.
The Senate has to pass this, right?
And so the good news is this is Thursday, and that actually matters because this recess or whatever they call it for 2 weeks, their 2 week vacation would start tomorrow. They want to get out of there. Time pressures them into a potential deal making situation.
Do you agree they can't leave?
Oh, they cannot leave. Now, the House will effectively leave, and they'll say, look, when you're ready to vote, come back, because the House really isn't part of the negotiation at this point. But let's not forget, that's a big piece here. You will have 20 or 30 Republicans in the House side, if the deal doesn't look great, are going to not be able to get there, and then they're going to have to negotiate with Democrats and potentially. So we're getting closer, and then yesterday we got further away, and hopefully the clock, the shot clock is ticking down. Both sides realize it. They're both losing, by the way. When 90% of America wants you to pay TSA agents and air traffic controllers and all this, and again, the air traffic controllers aren't part of this shutdown. They were part in October, but 90% of America says we want this to happen, yet they're still not making it happen. That's a layup politically for all of them.
And the president says, hey, I need some help, so I'm going to send ICE down there.
Yeah.
And here's some of the interaction yesterday. Cut 18.
These agents cannot do TSA's job, nor should they, and they aren't trained to do it.
Well, the ICE agents haven't been trained to do their ICE work. And now, I don't know what kind of training you're giving them in this short time, but I see them all sitting down looking at their phones or chit-chatting, but looks like they have no role to play.
I've been talking to my field leadership. The ICE agents that are there are doing non-specialized screening functions. It's been incredibly helpful to alleviate the burden on our workforce, and we're getting positive feedback from passengers and our field leadership alike.
So, yeah, nice. They're doing great.
And that last one was the TSA acting director.
Yeah. And by the way, Ha McNeil, the TSA director, is phenomenal. I mean, she's been managing this. She managed the shutdown in October. She and her team of Adam Stahl, you see him out there in the media, they've all been doing a tremendous job under all of this pressure. And whether it's TSA or National Guard, I don't care who you want to put there, the folks that have been providing some extra help, and the airlines are as well, they're managing the exit doors, the managing the lines, making sure people know where to go. They're not doing the specialized training that is required by TSA agents. It's allowing all the TSA agents with that training to focus, and it does allow them to open up some.
How is it hurting the airlines?
Boy.
Is it really affecting them?
Right,
I mean, they're leaving without passengers.
Yes, well, it affects us because, look, when you have a ticket that says United Airlines, God bless, United has a great product out there, but you're delayed 4 hours, you're like, you know, it's hard not to somehow blame the airlines. The airlines are doing a phenomenal job in this with the customer service, with the communication, letting people understand what the expectations are. But again, the federal government is destroying customer service. Every time we get any sort of momentum under our wings, they do something to screw it up for everybody else. So it's frustrating because the airspace is a public-private partnership. Airlines do their part on the private side. The government has to live up to their end of the bargain on the public side. They are not doing that. They haven't done it pretty much consistently for the last 6 months. And the folks that suffer is the consumer. But we are seeing people still purchase tickets. It's safe. It's a strong market. You should still buy your tickets, plan for the summer. This is going to get resolved. This shouldn't change your long-term outlook.
How do you see your role, Kristen, in there?
Being a great communicator, right? And communicating not just with the airlines in terms of what we're seeing in D.C., but, you know, I go to the White House. I go to Capitol Hill. I work with Secretary Duffy and Brian Bedford and their teams very, very closely to make sure they understand, you know, Brian Bedford and the team at FAA, they have this great CEO mindset. It's an awesome change for Washington. They're rebuilding air traffic control. They're doing all this amazing stuff at lightning speed.
They are starting getting through that infrastructure.
Oh, yeah,
changes.
It's great. And that hasn't slowed down at all. So all the new technology that we need to make the whole system more efficient, you can land and take off more planes safer and faster with more resiliency. That's all happening because of Brian and Secretary Duffy. They're doing an amazing job. My job is to kind of make sure they understand kind of the politics of what's happening both on the other side of the aisle, maybe what we're hearing out of Washington, what we're hearing from customers, the pushback, you know, maybe what the airlines themselves, because I report right to the CEOs of the nine biggest air carriers and, you know, what they're seeing from their end. So my job is to communicate all that. It'd be a little bit of a nexus. We deal with TSA. We deal with CPB. We deal with obviously what's happening on the Hill. And that's a pretty awesome job. I love it. But it would be nice if I didn't have to manage two shutdowns in my first 6 months.
It's incredible.
It's crazy.
How's jet fuel affecting the prices?
Not good, because it's not – people look at oil going up 30-40%, but the price to really frack that jet fuel has doubled. And that has to – that goes right to the consumer. So we are seeing some temporary push on costs. I think they are going to come down. That's why I tell folks, you know, still buy into the summer, plan your vacations. FIFA World Cup is coming. You know, we have to put extra effort to make sure we're meeting all those demands. But – yeah, I think there's probably a little bit of a price surge here. It's just temporary. I think we're going to get the Strait of Hormuz. You're seeing more of the coalition come in to other countries that want to help secure the Strait. You know who's actually has a huge interest in securing the Strait? It's places like China. Right? They have even more of an interest in getting their oil out. So you are going to see a bigger coalition to ensure that that Strait is secured. You'll see the prices drop, I think, dramatically once that happens. And my guess is that's in pretty short term.
I mean, your dad must be able to talk to you about what it was like when Iran was a problem with George H.W. Bush, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, we go, oh,
I
trust
mean, this
me,
goes
yeah,
all the way back.
It goes all the way back. And look, is the Middle East crisis going to be solved? No, but obviously changing that regime, having a 180-degree turn on Iran, it changes the entire dynamic over there. You're just going to have issues, but it definitely changes the entire dynamic for the good.
You know what's amazing that happened in our lifetime? It used to be, well, the Middle East is a mess, one autocracy to another.
Yeah.
Now you look around, it's like, not really. It's just one.
Yeah.
You know, and they're sycophants.
Right.
Hezbollah and Hamas.
Right.
So you have the UAE, who sounds like an ally, a NATO ally, who says the U.S. is not in this alone. We're going to fix
this.
Right. We can't leave that. And Saudi Arabia, the same thing. Don't leave these guys in power. Oman, same thing. So look, are they perfect democracies that we want? No. But I'm not looking to do that. I'm not looking to judge them that way. They have a Western philosophy. They want to invest here. Iran is the problem.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, look, the Saudis called, the Ayatollah, the Hitler of the Middle East, right? I mean, it was that horrific of a situation. And a lot of again, it's understandable. A lot of Americans maybe don't look at the realities there, but it's really, really severe. And look, let's give President Trump some credit. He's been able to stand a strong, staunch ally, supporter and backer of what's happening in Israel. And I think that's terrific. At the same time, building a coalition and building economic opportunity with all the other members of the Middle East. So he's really balanced.
Can you talk politics at all? How your brother's
sure.
doing?
Sure.
How's your brother doing?
He's doing awesome.
So he's running. He's trying to get the nomination first, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not really a primary, but yeah, he'll blow through the primary, I think, pretty strong. And then, you know,
Scott Brown's in there. He's
yeah, you know.
But you don't think he's going to stand in the way?
No. I mean, look, Scott Brown has made himself as politically ill. Scott Brown's like the Brian Bosworth of politics. He had like two strong years back in 2010. Where have you been lately? Just a kind of a consummately losing races. So God bless him. Thanks for playing. The focus has to be winning this seat. And that's, we have the smallest general, the shortest general election in the country. Only 2 months, September, October. So, you know, my brother's out there doing his thing and he's raising money and all that. And he's talking the right way in that he's focusing on New Hampshire. What's best for New Hampshire, the live free or die state, right? This kind of bastion of economic and individual freedom up in a very blue Northeast. We've been able to keep it a little bit red, which is great. And for a state that tends to be a little centrist, we've only had one side. Only Democrats have represented New Hampshire and Washington for 10 years. So people say it's a blue state without realizing all of the state government is run by Republicans. So we have a great opportunity just to have a balance of voice. My brother's, you know, he's done it before. He did a great job. And it's going to be a close race, I think, as all these Senate races are. There's probably four or five coin tosses, and that's going to really dictate what happens in the opportunities that Republicans can bring to the table in 27. It's all a get out the vote. It's not really even about policy. It's about getting the vote out. And right now, you have to give Democrats credit. In their special elections, they have galvanized some energy on their side all across the country. If you have a high voter, a strong voter turnout on the Republican side, there's no doubt my brother would win. But you got to make sure that people show up on election day. And in New Hampshire, by the way, you got to do it on election day. We don't do the mail-in voting or all that nonsense. Everyone shows up. And as long as they get out the vote, he's going to be successful, I think.
Well, it's interesting because they look at maybe Michigan and New Hampshire as the best chances for Republicans to flip a seat.
Flip, yeah. And that's great to be able to talk about flipping a seat in a midterm year, you know, which is, you know, sometimes people say, well, you're not going to win anything in the midterms. No, we really can make some ground here for sure. And then you have other seats out there, Georgia and North Carolina, a few others that will play. It's Tim Scott. Love Tim Scott. He's been doing a great job with the U.S. Senate, raising money, driving a lot of opportunity for these candidates nationally. So it's going to be a fun November, that's for sure. What's really interesting is, you know, what 2027 looks like. What, depending on what the House and Senate dynamics are, how does that adjust? I don't think it adjusts the president's agenda. But they'll definitely have to like reconsider their strategies in terms of moving forward.
Well, it's going to be interesting because you have to, if you're going to run for president, you got to hit the ground running right after.
Yeah,
the midterm,
when's that?
Right.
But
I mean, you tell me. You're the sununu.
Look, I've talked to the president a couple of times in the past year. I think you probably talked to him a little more than I do. The question is, you know, when does the president, President Trump, say go for the Republicans? Because no one will really want to get out ahead of him. He also understandably doesn't want to, you know, be seen as not as relevant as he was, because he has a lot to do in his agenda. I think he's doing a very good job with his agenda. He's got to drive forward on a few more things, and I think there's some more opportunity there. But when do we say go? I don't think it's so much as a party. I think the president kind of has to give a little bit of a blessing there, right? Because if you get out ahead of him, you don't want to tick
him
off.
Well, for the vice president, sure. But, I mean, do you think Ted Cruz is going to run? To me, there's no doubt about it.
Okay, Ted Cruz, Glenn Youngkin.
I think Youngkin could absolutely get in. I think that Senator Josh Hawley would. I think he envisions himself running for president.
On the, kind of a populist style, you know.
He'll check with the president.
No, like, Josh definitely won't. You know, Josh definitely won't check with the president.
But do you agree with me that Rubio doesn't run if the vice president runs?
I do not agree with that. No. No, because look, and by the way, I think they get along great. I think they're a good team. I think they're both doing some really good stuff. But just because one runs doesn't mean the other. If Iran turns out the way we hope it does that open a door for Cuba? That would be a great potential diplomacy opportunity for someone like Rubio. That would be his win. I mean, it really would be. It's hard to for someone who might have aspirations of being president. And I think, by the way, I think both the vice president and Rubio would be great presidents. I mean, they would be very strong.
But they're different. They're different.
Very different.
Their foreign policy is very different.
But they're smart. They are. And their foreign policy is very different, but either of them would make a very strong president.
They're good on their feet,
so,
both of them.
Yeah. And Rubio, look, you know, if you look at the dynamics, just a guy coming from New Hampshire, what does it take to win in Iowa and New Hampshire, put together a ground game, not just have a message?
Doesn't it blow you away, Chris?
But earn it with shoe leather.
That you have to say it's Iowa, New Hampshire. How many campaigns were just dead after Iowa, and then they just die after New Hampshire?
That's it.
It is kind of crazy, isn't it?
You
know, if you lose the first two, you really shouldn't be in there anymore.
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean,
Unless it's real close.
I guess we're just really, really good in New Hampshire at what we do.
Except for Democrats don't want to make New Hampshire number
They
number
don't,
one.
But boy, I would hope they learned their lesson last time. I mean, that's one of the reasons
they
got so crushed.
Do you know
They haven't made their final decision yet.
South Carolina last time.
It was South Carolina last time. I think there's a lot of inter-party struggle going. We ignored New Hampshire. We paid a terrible price for it because all of a sudden now we're basically blessing.
But wait a second. They did win New Hampshire. Didn't Kamala Harris win New Hampshire?
No. Biden won New Hampshire technically, right?
In the last election, New Hampshire went to Kamala Harris, didn't it?
Oh, in the general.
Yeah.
Yeah, by like 1%. By 1%. I'm always, the president has reminded me both times he lost New Hampshire in 16 and 24 was the closest race that
besides
he lost.
That, he's over it.
We almost get him over the line every time. But no, I mean, in the primary itself, they skipped it. They can't skip it this time. Or they would at their own peril.
But you know what bothers Democrats?
What?
Because it's too white. Okay, they go, that's not really what our party's about.
That's crazy. You have the most... like the most educated workforce,
that's
you have the highest
matters.
Voter turnout,
yes.
And you again, they tend to be a party that it wants to bless folks at the party level as opposed to listen to the voters. So,
and let's end the way we started. Prediction on when the impasse stops. I hope today.
I think a deal's made in the next 48 hours. I don't think you'll see the airports truly come back until next week.
Chris Sununu, thanks so much.
All right, you bet, brother.
One crisis after another.
I'm here for it. I can handle it.
Back in a moment.
Big guests, bold opinions, better information. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Not sure how to tackle your taxes? Are you sweating the small print? You may be experiencing FOMO, the fear of messing up. The answer? Using TurboTax on Intuit Credit Karma. They help you get your biggest refund, and then we help you do more with it with a personalized plan designed to help you hit your money goals. It's time to take your taxes to the max. Start filing today in the Credit Karma app.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We need to cover Iran, but I'm just telling you, people who vote, they're looking at gas prices, and they're looking at the airport, and they're not too dumb to understand on social media that Republicans, once again, had a chance to vote for TSA funding, and they voted it down. Let me say that again. Republicans now, 10 times, all they had to do is say yes, and TSA funding would have passed. They won't do it.
And guess what? Then they would all of a sudden, the ICE funding would be different. Number one, they had to not fund ICE, even though it was already funded in the big, beautiful bill. They had to put masks on, have judicial warrants. You understand that? And if they want to go ahead and isolate ICE, that's exactly what Democrats want. This is a Democratic, problem. It is not a Republican problem. The first one, I thought it was a Democratic problem to hold out in October for the funding on subsidies that were supposed to evaporate under Joe Biden when it came to health care. Do you ever see Democrats talk about health care? They never talk about health care because it was just used as a way to show that you're tough standing up to Donald Trump. And then everything's funded. Appropriation bills are done. Minneapolis happens. And they say we're going to reform ICE or we're not going to fund it. And now it comes to the point where no one's getting paycheck. So what are you supposed to do? Anytime someone doesn't like the behavior of one law enforcement agency, then we're going to have to do whatever Democrats want. Like, for example, what they wanted 4 years ago was to defund that agency. Should we do that? Should we go ahead and take the Democrats' lead and give up police stations if people feel there's racial inequities when it comes to law enforcement? That's what Minneapolis does. Do you want to take your lead from them? Joe Scarborough is probably comfortable doing that. That's why he's on a solidly Democratic channel. And go ahead, have at it. Just real quick, I can't wait to meet you in person. And we have a whole bunch of tour dates. You never did this before. Lined up, History, Liberty, and Laughs. And then we go to Uniting the States, which is a book I have come out in October. So I want to see you May 30th in Reno, Nevada. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets. Streamed on Fox Nation. And then it'll be July 11th in Pensacola, Florida. Then Red Bank, New Jersey, October 16th. Next day, Westbury, New York. Followed by Clearwater, Florida, November 7th. Jacksonville, Florida, November 8th. WOKV listeners, of course. Chesterfield, Missouri, November 21st. Everyone from St. Louis, hope to see you there at the factory again with a brand new show. BrianKilmeade.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there, Brian Kilmeade. Moving forward this hour, we're going to talk a lot about the war. Admiral Mark Montgomery, senior fellow at the Cyberspace Consortium and Commission Education Executive Director. He's a senior fellow of the FDD and U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, really understands taking these Karg Islands to different islands and getting that straight open. We'll discuss that. Mark Thiessen standing by. He's all over this. And, of course, we'll take your calls. But let's get to the big three.
Number three.
You had Google's A-team here. You had Meta's A-team here. They had the best lawyers that their money could buy. And they went after us and went after poor Kaylee and her family like vultures over a carcass.
Social media titans whacked. Addiction built in. The addiction suit goes against them. And now thousands of cases are on deck to do titanic damage to Meta, to TikTok, to YouTube, and so much more. It's time for action in Congress. We'll discuss it.
Number two.
Is America more or less safe because of this government shutdown?
We are really concerned about our security posture.
The threat environment is too dynamic for to allow this shutdown to continue on.
We are crippling our disaster response and recovery abilities.
Yep, America is less safe. We had those hearings yesterday about DHS. The partial shutdown continues as almost 500 TSA agents decide just to walk out and quit. Many are walking away temporarily, getting other jobs because they're not getting paid. Who is running the Democratic Party?
Number one.
We are on a path to completely eliminate Iran's wider military manufacturing apparatus, which is why my operational assessment continues to be Iran's combat capability is declining as U.S. combat capability continues to increase.
DHS still shut down, as you know. Meanwhile, they will talk this weekend, but I'd rather Trump finish them off. I'm talking about Iran and do it for good. We'll discuss all that. That was Admiral Brad Cooper. So now they're supposed to meet in Pakistan. I hear that the vice president's going to go. Marco Rubio will be there. Not sure if Jared and Witkoff will come, but they don't want to deal with them. They want to deal with the vice president. Not that it matters that much either way, but I just think for the most part, we are responsible for finishing the job. That's the only thing our Gulf allies ask for. Don't leave them intact thinking that they won. Let's bring in Mark Thiessen. Mark, are we winning?
Oh my gosh, we're decimating them. This is going to be one of the greatest military victories that any American president has had in my lifetime. And there's no hesitation on the part of Donald Trump about finishing this job. He has done, he said early on in this campaign, he said, the only deal that we're negotiating is unconditional surrender. And what he's done is he's put terms of unconditional surrender on the table. And the Iranians, they can take that deal or he can execute the terms through a military campaign. And he's fine doing either one. And he's right to talk to them. He's right to give them a chance to capitulate. But he's not capitulating and he's not in any hurry to end this. The economy is strong. The Dow hit 50,000 before this thing started. Perfect time to do this. And the economy is going to bounce back as soon as it's over. So he's not in any sense of hesitation about
the one focus is going to be obviously is getting that strait open again, and we have we have 5,000 Marines heading in that direction, and we also know that the Iranians said if you try to take Karg Island, we're going to stop you from using the Red Sea, and we're going to use the Houthis to do it. Your reaction?
I don't think Donald Trump is afraid of the Houthis, and I don't think he's afraid of Iran. Look, the reason the Iranians are in a incredibly weak position. We are in the process of executing a very specific military plan. None of the military aims have been achieved yet, but they are all in the process of being achieved. And we're given 3 more weeks, Admiral Cooper believes that he can execute all of the president's military objectives and tasks that he's given him, including opening the Strait of Hormuz by force, including eliminating their enrichment capability and future enrichment, and including taking Karg Island if he's ordered to do that. All of these things are achievable, and Iran has really no say in the matter.
So here's the U.S. demands. Dismantle nuclear facilities, zero nuclear enrichment, missile constraints, guaranteed free and safe passage through the strait, and end to Iran's proxy support in the region. Iran says guarantee you won't be attacked again. Full sanction relief, compensation for the war, and a new payment system for the Strait of Hormuz. They're charging $2.5 million to have a tanker go through the Strait of Hormuz, and I believe Pakistan and India are paying that.
Yeah, we're going to control the Strait of Hormuz in a matter of weeks. I don't think anyone's going to have to pay the Iranians anything. And as for compensation, yeah, let's get in line. Let's start with compensation for our embassy in Beirut. Let's start with compensation for the thousands of U.S. soldiers who were killed with your EFPs in Iraq. Let's start with compensation for blowing up our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Once you pay us back for all the damage that you've done to us over 47 years, we can talk about compensation.
So this is the problem. American people who aren't as involved in and maybe have the contacts that you have say, well, you know, what's going on here? Congressman Seth Moulton, a veteran, said this, cut 12.
There is absolutely no plan. The administration clearly can't even understand why they're in this war, what their strategy is to get out of it. If you look every step of the way, they're doing things to they're changing their goals. They're doing things that don't even necessarily contribute to their goals. Apparently now their primary goal is reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which, let's be clear, was open before Trump started this war of choice. So the reality is, at this moment, we are losing this war.
Mark.
What a moron. I mean, truly, it's like, you know, one, that's stupid analysis that is not borne by any facts. And two, he's rooting for defeat. He's rooting for the enemy. These guys, these people hate Donald Trump more than they hate the Iranian regime. If you hate Donald Trump more than the Iranian regime to the point that you're talking down our military and rooting for failure, then you're what's wrong with America. Look, Admiral Cooper presented a plan to the commander in chief at the start of this operation, and he is executing it flawlessly. It's conditions based. One of the conditions that came up is that they've shut down the Strait of Hormuz. That was anticipated as a possible contingency. Our military has been planning for doing contingency plans for an Iran war for three decades. You think nobody thought, I wonder what would happen to the Strait of Hormuz? Like, they didn't have any plan. Admiral Cooper has a plan to open the Strait of Hormuz by force. It involves taking out their offensive capability, involves counter-drone capabilities, it involves electronic warfare, and there are ways to protect, and it involves escorts of ships through the Strait of Hormuz. All of that together, you're going to open up the Strait of Hormuz. This Iranian regime is getting weaker we've hit 10,000 targets inside Iran, and we're not done yet. It's insane to say we're losing. You have to be mentally deficient.
So
to think we're losing.
What blows me away is these people are politicians, but veterans. They are using the prestige that they earn, and I give them credit for serving, to say we're losing. Jason Crow, same thing. We're losing. We don't need to do this. There was no threat there. Are you kidding me?
They want us to lose.
Yeah, you know better. And listen to this former CIA director, John Brennan. Listen to this.
Iran, like, they are an authoritarian regime who's known to lie, but like, I'm confused. What is going on? Help me. Calm me down.
Well, I tend to believe Iran more than I do Donald
That's crazy.
Trump, because he could not acknowledge the truth even when it is, he's slapped in the face with it repeatedly. And it's clear that, you know, he is flailing right now. He's trying to figure out how he's going to get out of this debacle that he has created. And so he's going to make these claims about negotiations, that the Iranians now are sending signals that they really want to make a deal, and indicates that they're going to make a deal on our terms. I don't think anything close to the truth in that statement.
So he takes the CIA director mantle, use that credibility to rip the president. Your thoughts?
Yeah, these are the same people who told us that Donald Trump was colluding with Russia to steal the 2016 election.
And made sure when he got out of office, that went out of the way for the next 2.5 years to make sure that investigation moved forward.
John Brennan said that he was a Russian agent. I mean he was an operative for Vladimir Putin. I mean, this guy has clowned himself on the international stage. I wouldn't take a word that he says seriously. I just find it amazing. Like, I look, we all know that in Iraq and other places, eventually, you know, people on the left turned against the war, turned against the president. But I've never seen it happen from day one.
I know.
You know, we're 3 weeks into a conflict in which we've lost just over a dozen servicemen, half of them in an accident, and had several hundred injured. Their sacrifice is enormously painful to their families and to our country, but that's the lowest level of casualties you've probably seen in a major military conflict in modern American history. The U.S. has inflicted such pain on the Iranian regime. We've destroyed their offensive capability. We've destroyed their air defenses. We can fly over Tehran without any fear of being hit. We are taking out their missile production. We're taking out their nuclear production. We're going to get their nuclear dust, as President Trump calls it, and we're going to seize Karg Island and take their control of their oil. how is that defeat?
That's why world that defeat.
And people who are saying it's defeat, you look in the mirror for a second, you know, truly look in the mirror. You're a disgrace to your country and to your uniform.
I would say this. Think about this in a couple of weeks when all those things happen and all those people who said the war is lost and there was no plan, they're going to look pretty stupid and we're going to bring all those sound bites back. The other thing is Pakistan's reporting that the foreign minister Abbas Argarachi was targeted. The Israelis had his coordinates and they called the U.S. and said, please don't kill him. We have nobody else to talk to. So they let him live to go to Pakistan. So they killed the IRGC head of the Navy who actually caused all the chaos in Hormuz. Remember, they wiped out the Ayatollah and between 40 and 55 of the higher ups in the Iranian regime. And they said, well, you replaced the 89-year-old, 86-year-old with a 58-year-old. Really? Where is he? Is he even alive? We've seen some pictures online. I can't verify them, but either he's scared to death or he is totally incapacitated. So for those people who want that narrative in America, you can't have it because it's not working. Ali Larijani, dead. He was the one calling us out, walking the streets last Friday. He was dead on Monday. So between working with the Israelis and achieving our objectives, I'm extremely encouraged from where we're at right now. And then I want you to hear last night another great guest for Brett Baer. He had on the UAE Minister of State, who is extremely supportive. Cut 19, Lana Nusabai. Cut 10.
I think we start with securing the Straits of Hormuz. We should be able to do that in the near future. I think building out on that, we need a diplomatic off-ramp of negotiations with whoever is in charge in Iran about its ballistic missile weapons program and its nuclear enrichment program. I mean, to your point about why diplomacy hasn't worked, they told us they didn't have a nuclear enrichment program. Today, we know they have enough enriched uranium to make up to 12 bombs. They told us they didn't have a ballistic missiles weapons program that could threaten anyone. They can now reach most capitals in Europe, including also the Gulf, which they've demonstrated they're willing to do. 89% of their targets have been civilian infrastructure in my country. This has to stop.
And UAE has gotten hit by more rocket and drone fire than Israel. So, I can't, Mark, this is what we're saying. This is the UAE minister. These Gulf states are in the line of fire. Instead of saying, oh, let's stop this, they say, let's stop this the right way.
No, it's exactly right. And we're going to achieve the, I mean, all of these people ought to really be, who are criticizing this war and saying we're losing and all of that. You really ought to, you know, you really ought to hold your fire because you're going to look like clowns in a few weeks. You really are. I mean, you know, all as you say. I mean, Ryan, you're keeping records. You're keeping Absolutely. Notes. Everybody's keeping notes. We're going to play all these stupid clips once the war is over, and the entire Gulf is behind us. The entire, you know, and Europe, you know, who we can't get to. We're at first weren't even letting us to use their bases. Now we know that the Iranians were able to hit them. You know, Donald Trump is saving the free world from a new. Can you imagine what the last few years would have looked like if Hamas and Hezbollah were fighting under an Iranian nuclear umbrella?
And knowing that they'll use it, look what they've already done.
So I'll tell you something about Donald Trump. The biggest mistake American presidents have made for the last century and a half has been not taking the words of the enemy seriously. So Lenin, before the Russian Revolution, wrote a pamphlet called What is to be Done, in which he laid out his plans to build a communist empire in Russia and take over the world. And we didn't listen to him, and look what happened. Hitler wrote Mein Kampf and told us that he planned to build a 1,000-year Reich and eradicate the Jews. We didn't listen to him. World War II. Osama bin Laden in 1996 wrote a fatwa declaring war in America and saying he's going to bring the war to our homeland. We didn't listen. 9/11. 2021, Vladimir Putin writes a pamphlet on his website saying that the Ukrainian and Russian people are the same and he's going to conquer Ukraine. We didn't listen. Look what happened. Donald Trump is the first president to take the words of the enemy seriously. When the Iranians said, death to America, death to Israel, we're getting a nuclear weapon, he said, we're going to stop them before they do that. He's the first president to do that. And that is going to put him in a place in history that is unsurpassed in terms of commanders in chief in our history.
And Mark, if you haven't thought of that as a column, I think you got your next column. Am I right?
It's coming. It's coming.
I'll act surprised when I read it.
By the way, I'll preview another column for you.
Yep.
Pete Hegseth is one of the most effective secretaries of defense in American history. If you think of what the last 14 months he's done, the Houthi operation, Midnight Hammer, Nigeria, Venezuela. We just saw what an amazing operation that was in the State of the Union address where we met the pilot that went in and captured and landed that helicopter. And now this operation. Name me a Secretary of Defense who has pulled up that kind of a record in a matter of 14, 15 months. Pete Hegseth is doing an amazing job. This team is doing an amazing job. And we're led by a commander-in-chief who is unafraid. All these people running around saying, oh, he wants to negotiate. He's fear. He's feeling pressure on the economy. Bullshit. Bullshit. Right. Sorry, I'm not allowed to say that on air.
Yeah, you're probably not.
But you can beep that out. Yes. But I mean... Yes, there you go.
Mark,
he is not at all cowed. He is not at all worried. He's not at all nervous.
Mark,
no, you got to shut up.
Our viewers, thank you very much. And some of our listeners. Back in a moment.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You had Google's A-team here. You had Meta's A-team here. They had the best lawyers that their money could buy. And they went after us and went after poor Kaylee and her family like vultures over a carcass. I mean, they were all over everything. And they didn't win. And so we're deeply appreciative, and I do think it bodes well for the other thousands of cases that are out there.
And that is the lawyer for the family that says that their daughter was addicted to social media, and Meta knew exactly what they were doing. TikTok knew exactly what they were doing. Instagram knew exactly what they were doing, and so did YouTube. And in the end, prior to this, TikTok settled, and so did the other outlets settled, but Meta fought it, and they lost. And now the money's not huge. I mean, it's basically a parking ticket for them. But there's about 6,000 other lawsuits from different families whose families have suffered or their kids have died because they say these social media companies have conspired to addict their kids and poison their minds. So this is going to force some legislation and end the immunity. I don't want it to destroy the companies. They just got to act more responsible. For example, if you are a cigarette company, you can't market to children. Same with liquor, right?
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
For decades, Iranian warships have roamed regional waters, threatening and harassing global shipping. But those days are over because we've now destroyed 92% of the Iranian Navy's largest vessels. They're not sailing, and my operational assessment is that they've now lost the ability to meaningfully project naval power and influence around the region and around the world.
So there you go, and that is Admiral Bradley Cooper, CENTCOM commander, reviewing what we're up to and how they're ahead of schedule. Yes, it's true they can send off rockets. It's true they still have drones. It's still true the Strait of Hormuz, they are in control over, but little by little, they're losing limb after limb. How does Admiral Mark Montgomery see it? FDD senior fellow, U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, now retired, and U.S. Cyberspace Solarium Commission Executive Director. Admiral, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me, Brian.
So, Admiral, how would you characterize the progress made?
I agree. This is a very deliberate, 4 to 5 week campaign to remove their ability to launch and project ballistic missiles and produce them in the future, drones and produce them in the future, a Navy and produce it in the future, enemy air defense, IRGC leadership, and finally the nuclear program. All of them are moving along. They're different levels. The ballistic missile is ahead of the drone. The suppression of enemy air defense is done. As he mentioned, the naval power projection capability is gone. But other things still have to be done. There's work to be done. I hope the president gives Admiral Cooper and General Kane the time they think they need to finish the job and make it. Maybe there's not regime change, but there's a significant change in what the regime can do to harass and terrorize its Arab neighbors, Israel and the United States.
So For example, how would you open up the Strait, Admiral?
Yeah. So what we're doing right now, which is you have to remove their anti-ship cruise missiles. I think they're very low, if not gone. Their drones, that is still up in the air. Their surface craft, those are almost all gone, the ones that could come out and attack a merchant ship, and their mines. You have to lower all four of those to an acceptable military risk that you can start doing convoy ops. Once you remove their ability to project the power, get it down to something where Admiral Cooper goes, I can take the risk. Something may go wrong, but I can manage it and mitigate it with the forces I put there, and then assemble the forces over it. And those forces are generally in theater. It's F-15s, F-16s, F-18s, and combat air patrols. It's 10 to 14 destroyers to do the escorts. It's A-10s and armed helos to get rid of any surface craft that sneak out. And then the unblinking eye to keep an eye, you know, to make sure that a threat doesn't pop up. Once you have that, you can do convoy operations. You know, that's in weeks. And the one unknown is if they've truly mined it, we're going to have to first, before we do convoys, sweep through there with our littoral combat ships with their mine modules, and, you know, protected by air defense assets to make sure that we remove the reportedly dozen mines they put in the Straits.
Is it helpful that it looks like the British are sending a minesweeper?
Yeah, I think this is, if there's criticism of what the either CENTCOM or the administration did here, we should have asked the Brits on day two. Because I'm going to tell you, nothing moves slower than a minesweeper. It's going to take them 3 or 4 weeks to transit all the way to the Gulf. Same with Germans, same with Lithuania. There are lots of we have good allies in Europe. I was in Lithuania last week. The Lithuanians, the Poles, I think the Germans, I think the Dutch, and the Brits, all very good minesweeper navies, would provide minesweepers. And I wish we'd asked on day one or two, because it takes 4 or 5 days to get a ship ready to go, maybe a little bit longer, and then, you know, 21 to 28 days to get there. I think the French ones could get there a little faster if they're on in their Mediterranean ports. So it's going to take a while.
So for that to happen, and they say that the drone sheds or the drone tunnels are way below, but beyond our bunker busters. Would you say that's correct?
I don't know if they're beyond a massive ordnance penetrator. I don't want to undersell a massive ordnance penetrator, the damage it can do. I think what they are is probably lower than our 5,000 pounds, our mini MOPs can do. The ones that are not dropped by B-2s, the ones that are dropped by fighter attack. We'll have to see. Look, there's always going to be drones out there. We're going to have to be able to shoot down drones. The good news is F-15s, F-16s, and F-18s with advanced precision kill weapon system, that 2.75-inch rocket you and I have talked about Ukraine having. You know, we gave them to Ukraine for their F-16s. We have them on our aircraft. And the beauty of those is when you're defending a point, a signal area, a convoy, it's much easier. The problem we're having in the Mideast broadly is that we're having to defend 500 miles wide by 500 miles deep. There, the aircraft aren't enough, but they'll be enough to defend a convoy against a drone attack. So I'm worried about them. I'm not mission critical worried about them.
So I thought Lena Nusimbaugh, the UAE Minister of State, really strong, showing how determined they are. UAE, I did not know this, has had more drones and rockets pointed at their shot at them than Israel. Cut 10.
I think we start with securing the Straits of Hormuz. We should be able to do that in the near future. I think building out on that, we need a diplomatic off-ramp of negotiations with whoever is in charge in Iran about its ballistic missile weapons program and its nuclear enrichment program. I mean, to your point about why diplomacy hasn't worked, they told us they didn't have a nuclear enrichment program. Today we know they have enough enriched uranium to make up to 12 bombs. They told us they didn't have a ballistic missiles weapons program that could threaten anyone. They can now reach most capitals in Europe, including also the Gulf, which they've demonstrated they're willing to do. 89% of their targets have been civilian infrastructure in my country. This has to stop.
I mean, it sounds like she's seeing exactly what we've been saying, Admiral.
And the UAE has been a stand-up partner of the United States in this. As you mentioned, they've taken more than 60% of the inbound ballistic. I mean, a majority, the inbound ballistic missiles, the inbound drones. That's because Iran hates the UAE more than all the other Gulf Cooperation Council states added together. And the UAE has pushed back hard. We should follow their leader, Mohammed bin Zayed. Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia, I think they're telling the president the right answer. You've got to press the case home here. You finally did what America has been unwilling to do for 25 years. Despite 1,000 Americans being killed by the IRGC, we've been unwilling to hold them accountable for their terroristic behavior throughout the Middle East. And the UAE and Saudi Arabia are willing to stand by us to do it. I would not be surprised if the UAE starts, you know, conducting offensive operations against Iran in the near future to demonstrate their willingness to fight side by side with the United States and Israel against a terroristic regime in Tehran.
And MBS has basically said the Ayatollah was Hitler, and this regime's got to be stopped. And they're worried about us leaving early because of it. And if the neighbors are standing strong while taking incoming, and now still believe in us and this mission, the least we could do is not leave them in Iran that's going to be harassing their neighbors. Because at some point, we're going to have to leave. We have to pull out some of the 50,000 troops we have there and all the ships.
That's right. We have to leave them. In the end, we need to leave them in charge with a much, you know, returning to our slimmed down version in the Middle East. But right now, it's critical for the president to listen to our Arab partners, to listen to Israel. Press home the case. No one's economies are being affected more than UAE, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and Bahrain. Yet they want us to press home this fight. They know we're at that inflection point where we can break the grip of the IRGC on the region.
Absolutely. So, Admiral, what concerns do you have in the last couple of weeks looking at from the military point of view?
Yeah. Look, I'm glad we're bringing the Marines in. I hope we're using them for what's called non-combatant evacuation operations. In other words, if things get a little sporty around one of our embassies or consulates, the Marines are professionals at extracting our embassy team, extracting U.S. citizens from peril. They're wonderful at that. I'm not excited about a Karg Island invasion. I just feel at this point that would tie up too many forces, and that we would get it. We could seize it. We have the best ground forces in the world. But holding it would be such a risk to mission and risk to force. It would draw forces away from taking over the Straits of Hormuz, because you'd have to have Navy destroyers all the way up in the Gulf defending those units. And it would be risk to force. We would lose a number of ground of soldiers, airmen, and sailors trying to hold that spot. We can make Karg Island ineffective for Iran by just sinking the next merchant ship that plans to pull in. We tell them, we warn them, do not pull in or we will sink you 10 miles out. Do not pull in, we'll sink you. 5 miles out, you're a lawful combatant, we're sinking you. And that will be a message to all the other Iranian merchant ship captains. I'm not going to Karg Island.
So you're saying by being a presence there without taking it is just as good?
Just as good. And look, even if we took it, it isn't like we own their oil and natural gas. They'll just turn off the spigot at the mainland, right? So no need to seize and hold it. Destroy the military infrastructure on it and
tell people
do not pull in. Yeah, which is done. And if they redo it, good. You gave us more targets. Happy to take them out too. In the meantime, tell the merchant ships, if you pull in, we will sink you a reasonable distance away so that when this is all over, we can go back in and start pumping again.
Understood. Admiral, a lot of moving parts, but this is a very dynamic time. But overall, when people say this is a war of choice, as a guy who studies and been involved in our military for decades, what do you tell people?
When something's a war of choice for 40 years, when someone is fighting you and aggressive against your interests for 40 years, at some point, it's not so much as a war of choice, but a war to remove a aberrant actor, someone who's working against your national security interest for 40 years in the Middle East. And yes, the timing was of our choice, but the need, the necessity was driven by Iran's actions, not by President Trump's decision making. Their actions required this. By the way, remember the last thing they did? They killed 27 to 32,000 of their own people in a weekend. For protesting. On top of everything else, there, and why I don't understand why progressives aren't more supportive of this, this is the most evil regime. They exceed Russia and China in their wanton killing of their own people. Now, the Russians do a lot in Ukraine that's worse. But what they're doing to their own people is a significant, should have a significant impact on how progressives view this war of choice.
And by the way, Ukraine, side note, has taken 100 square miles for the first time since 2023 in Russia. So they're making some progress. They also blew up a major oil installation about a week ago. So they're not giving up. They're not quitting.
You're right. The biggest one of those is that long-range strike. Their ability now to impose costs on Russia's economy and on their military infrastructure complex at range is going to make hard choices for Vladimir Putin over the next 6 to 9 months.
Right. As soon as we could stop him, we go put the sanctions back in place after this conflict is done. Admiral, thanks so much. Correct. Appreciate it. It's a time in which we need your expertise almost on a daily basis. Admiral Mark Montgomery, appreciate it. Back in a moment.
Thanks for having me.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Before he was elected to the Senate, Mark Wayne Mullen was a low-level MMA fighter and a plumber. That's right. We have a plumber protecting us from terrorism now. I work for Super Mario. Why not, Mark Wayne?
So how ridiculous is that? This talks about, remember when Jimmy Kimmel came out and started insulting Charlie Kirk, said no big deal that he was murdered, and he thought it was funny? And he got a huge blowback, got suspended, came back, all that stuff that swirled around, got it. Now, the other night, he decides that Mark Wayne Mullen's not qualified to be DHS secretary because he's a plumber. Does he not understand the respect that plumbers deserve, number one? Number two, do you not understand the situation? He takes over his dad's company, grows it to this huge company, opens up a series of other businesses, including restaurants, then goes into serving Congress simultaneously. Then he ascends to the Senate. And he does a fantastic job going across aisles, being a part of almost every major decision, constantly on the air, constantly explaining the story, very tight with President Trump, proving that he's a fantastic leader, CEO type. And you don't think he's qualified? And then you mock the fact that he's a plumber? I mean, how tone deaf are you to mock the fact that he's a plumber? And number one, he was actually on one of our local affiliates, KRMG, doing a weekend show because he wanted to communicate with people. All he wants to do, this is the service. For example, in life, you're not supposed to be a professional politician in theory. You're supposed to be somebody that at one point does a series of things of service. You don't do it as much as it's good pay to get six figures. When you travel in both locations, especially in the distance of Oklahoma, you're not making much money after taxes. What you're doing is you're actually serving the country. If you're playing it honest, you're not taking advantage of your position to enrich yourself. And Mark Wayne Mullen does that. Number two is, you say low-level MMA fighter? He was a fantastic wrestler. He was en route to be an All-American college player until he had to drop out to help his family. Only lost one match in high school. And then when he went to MMA, he wasn't getting the fights he needed to pay his bills, so he had to go into the private sector and finish working for his family. Do you understand? So you're mocking the fact that he's not a UFC champion? So I hope he gets huge blowback, and I hope it's not just from the right. I hope it's from other people that realize that he is just people have out in Hollywood and in Los Angeles in those areas, they have no respect for the people doing the blue-collar jobs who made himself a white-collar CEO. They can also come over and fix your car and fix your and do your plumbing. Very few people have that type of skill. Believe me, I'm in awe of it. I don't have it. I don't have the act. It's not a choice. Nobody wants me working on their things. I'm not mechanically inclined. Not that I'm above it. I just don't have the ability to do it. That's why I have so much respect and always watch people that are doing it, whether you're putting in a water heater or you're building a house. I'm watching, helping. I'm a laborer. But for Jimmy Kimmel to put that down, it shows how clueless he is or his writers are. So best of luck. And I hope he gets huge blowback for it. Meanwhile, I want to talk about what's happening. Huge blowback. We have no TSA, partial shutdown of Homeland Security. They had a deal done where only 6% of DHS was not going to be funded. That would be the ICE portion. They would do it some other way. Meanwhile, go back to work. And the Dems agreed with it in principle on Sunday. But on Monday, when Schumer went back to his caucus, they said no. So he says no. They keep moving the goalpost over and over again. Here's Lindsey Graham. Cut 19.
2 days ago, I was asked to go to the White House with a group of senators to try to make the case that the deal that had been agreed to a couple of days ago between the R's and D's in the Senate about ERO funding, and after
good discussion. The president said, okay, we're going to do a reconciliation. I can live with that. Only to find out that they've withdrawn the deal. This can't be normal. You can't expect people like me and others to go solve problems and you create a new problem for us.
It's frustrating, beyond frustrating, that I see people waiting in lines for 4 or 5 hours and missing their plane. And this is totally correctable. John Fetterman knows it. Cut 22.
For me, I've said this from the beginning and remind everybody, there was a long, long shutdown just last year, too. And I was one of the rare Democrats to refuse that, too. And now here we are. Now I'm at the airport every week. I talk to countless TSA agents, and they are all hurting. They are angry. They are frustrating. They're exhausting, too, what they've been put through. Now, these are not wealthy people. They earn around $50,000 a year. That should be our wheelhouse. I mean, they're union government workers. And now if we refuse to give them a paycheck, no, don't talk about affordability if you don't even provide them with a paycheck.
I agree. Senator John Fetterman making more sense. By the way, his approval rating in Pennsylvania is not high among Democrats, but it is in the country. It really is. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Don't forget, go to BrianKilmeade.com and see me on the road, including at West Branch Music Fair on Long Island in October. Coming up next, November 30th, Reno, Nevada, and then in Pensacola, Florida, July 11th. Check out all the other dates in the fall. BrianKilmeade.com.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's a Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot going on. President is having a, cabinet meeting for everybody to see. I think Joe Biden had four in 4 years. And the president, none of them on television. They'll just walk in and say, get out. There's your photo op. And the president has all these guys, women, make their statements about their divisions and then answer any questions. He'll open up to the press at the end. And he's already has welcoming in Secretary Mark Wayne Mullins, who Jimmy Kimmel thinks a joke. I don't. And then now we have Steve Witkoff, special envoy, talking about how Iran was just trying to buy time. So there's going to be a lot of news made and we're going to be all over it. We'll bring you that. But now let's get to the big three.
Number three.
You had Google's A-team here. You had Meta's A-team here. They had the best lawyers that their money could buy. And they went after us and went after poor Kaylee and her family like vultures over a carcass.
And that is true. And that, of course, is Mark Lanier. He's got to be happy because he beat Meta. He beat YouTube and social media. And it looks like the parents who say that this was an addictive process done intentionally to corrupt their kids, well, they won. You might not think it's big damage, just a few million, which is like a parking ticket. But the bad news for those titans of social media, 6,000 other cases are coming, if not more.
Number two.
Was America more or less safe because of this government shutdown?
We are really concerned about our security posture.
The threat environment is too dynamic, sir, to allow this shutdown to continue on.
We are crippling our disaster response and recovery abilities by the day.
And does anyone doubt that? DHS still partially shut down as almost 500 TSA agents say, I'm through, I quit. And more are calling in sick, making your hours just to get on a plane last hours instead of minutes. Why won't this end? They better not leave town. I'm talking about Democrats and Republicans without fixing this.
Number one.
We are on a path to completely eliminate Iran's wider military manufacturing apparatus, which is why my operational assessment continues to be Iran's combat capability is declining as U.S. combat capability continues to increase.
No kidding. And that is the truth. That is Admiral Bradley Cooper, whose plans were sold off and signed off by the President of the United States to rip Iran down, their IRGC down to size, from their ballistic missile program to their drone program to their Navy that is virtually wiped out. We have to find a way for this rogue country to be reined in once and for all and to ultimately pay the price. Look, we've lopped off 60 of their biggest leaders. We just knocked off and lopped off the head of the IRGC Navy, which engineered the closing down of the Strait of Hormuz, which is rocketing up oil prices. It's around 90. It is around $90 a barrel. It was 60. That's what we wanted. 60 or 70. People make money on all sides then, and gas and oil is cheap. We're not there yet. but we're on our way. Do not listen to the people saying we are not achieving our goals, because we are. Big time. And the president is not blinking. Here's more from Admiral Bradley Cooper, Cut 7.
Before Operation Epic Fury, Iran had large-scale manufacturing capacities to not only build naval vessels, missiles, and attack drones, but also to advance and proliferate these technologies to regional and global bad actors. Today, we've damaged or destroyed over two-thirds of Iran's missile, drone, and naval production facilities and shipyards, and we're not done yet.
Right. Give them some time. Don't end it early. Now talks could take place in Islamabad, Pakistan, as early as this weekend, as the vice president and Marco Rubio will go. So listen, they think that the vice president is like Tucker Carlson, who doesn't want the war and doesn't want any part of it, and they think it'd be easy. I think you're wrong about that. I think he's going to thoroughly back the president, number one. Number two is they could have killed the foreign minister. They had him. They had his coordinates down. But they were asked by Pakistan and Egypt and Turkey not to, because they said he's the only reasonable person you can deal with over there. The problem is the foreign minister says one thing and then the IRGC does another. So it makes me wonder, we've killed so many. Who's actually calling the shots? Are there 32 separate commanders for every province? And I'm looking at a lot of the Arabic reporting, a lot of the Islamic Tehran reporting, and there's massive defections from the regular army. No one's getting paid. And now, because you've been bombing the Gulf states who have most of your money, they've frozen the funds. So as you rip this regime down to size in every way possible, like a anaconda, you slowly squeeze them to death. 92% of their naval vessels have been destroyed. Two-thirds missile, drone, and naval production facilities have been damaged. Coalition is forming. It's about 30 countries, and Iran's nuclear capabilities and proxy networks have been weakened substantially. Now, I know the polls aren't overwhelmingly strong for independents and Democrats, but for 74% of Republicans, according to the latest poll, it is. They are strong. And I think if you pull out a victory here, everything else works out. Big time. I could not be more impressed with the UAE Minister of State yesterday, Lana Nussbaum. She was on Special Report. Listen to her describe what UAE has been through and where they stand. Cut 9.
What happens in the Gulf clearly doesn't stay in the Gulf. So Iran's attack on Gulf allies of the United States and Jordan is an attack on the entire world and the world economy, including its closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Let's not forget that a fifth of the world's oil and gas goes through the Straits of Hormuz. 30% of its fertilizers for food production and harvest goes through the Straits of Hormuz. Almost every product known to every global supply chain coming from the Gulf goes through the Straits of Hormuz. So effectively, Iran is trying to give the global economy a heart attack. We should not allow Iran, a state sponsor of terrorism, to set the global price for food and gas.
Exactly. And he went on to say that America is not in this alone. So you want to continue to say that, you know, we had to do it for the element of surprise. But anyone who saw her build up and picked up the phone, part of NATO, and said, you know, what's going on? He's not going to tell you the exact date he's going to hit or what he's going to hit. He's going to say negotiations are happening, but there's an excellent chance I'm going to need military operations. So you're the German chancellor. You're meeting with the president of the United States. You had no idea that he's thinking about going into Iran. Did you see what he did in 2025 in June? Did you see that they're reconstituting, rebuilding? What have you done to stop it? Because now we saw two rockets go 2,500 miles, intermediate range rockets, to go to Diego Garcia that could hit Berlin, could hit London, could hit Paris. Does that bother you at all? They really can't hit us yet, but we wait till 2035 when, who knows, somebody who's in high school right now is president of the United States, and they go, wait a second. You allowed this country to be like North Korea, a nuclear nation, which we always heard from Clinton and everybody, all his successors, would never be nuclear powers, and then they become nuclear powers. Some don't think that's a big deal. I do. The other thing that's happening right now is the shutdown of our airports, thanks to TSA really hitting the road because they're not getting paid. So we had the acting director, TSA director, on yesterday, and they talked about what has happened and how, for the second time in 4 months, people making $50,000 a year were not getting paychecks while being asked to work. Cut 15.
Unfortunately, we have seen an over 500% increase in the frequency of assaults on our officers since this shutdown began. This is unacceptable and we will not be tolerated. We are pursuing all legal avenues to prosecute these incidents. To the traveling public, we ask for your patience and understanding as our officers are working their hardest to ensure you can travel safely, all the while not getting paid.
So it's just too, I just can't believe, I mean, they did nothing wrong. They're not being represented by a union that's demanding more money, and you could take your side, Reagan, Patco. Nothing, they did absolutely nothing wrong. And it is, the appropriations bills were signed off on. That's a fact, including DHS. And they decide that they don't like the way ICE is acting, so they're denying funds to the Coast Guard, cybersecurity, CISA, and they're among the other branches, TSA. And that affects us all. Crazy. Here's more from the acting director. And listen to this exchange. She talks at the end, but listen, and you hear at first a congressman from Missouri. Cut 17.
Ms. McNeil, is America more or less safe because of this government shutdown?
We are really concerned about our security posture and what the long-term impacts of the shutdown is going to have on the workforce and our ability to carry out the mission.
The threat environment is too dynamic, sir, to allow this shutdown to continue on.
We are crippling our disaster response and recovery abilities by the day.
Okay. It's a fact. And I know if you go to the airport right now, you expect the worst. It's going to be the worst. They better fix it. They had a couple of deals done on Sunday and Monday, and the Democrats have walked away. That's not a conjecture. That's a fact. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to Lieutenant Governor Burke Jones of Georgia. He's running for governor. Also, Georgia is a hot spot when it comes to the Senate race. John Ossoff, with thought by many to be the most vulnerable Democrat running for re-election. Is he going to be, as the Democrats, the Republicans go through a primary process, which is quite grueling. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Let's bring in Lieutenant Governor Burke Jones running for governor to replace Brian Kemp over in Georgia. Always a tough battle and a tough primary. Lieutenant Governor, welcome.
Hey, Brian, good morning. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. First off, I think it's a great move. Your governor just suspended the gas tax in Georgia, kind of make it a little bit easier. These blue states up the taxes in these times, especially when gas gets low. They want to make sure people pay too much. But where do you guys paying roughly now per gallon?
It's about 30 cents on regular and about 37 cents on diesel. So we suspended the gas tax for 60 days. And obviously that, you know, that with the prices going up like they have, obviously that's a big boost to people's pocket. We always like to try to do things, put money back in the people, citizens of the state's pocket, as opposed to some of these other blue states you were talking about that seem to just want to take.
No, I hear you. And right now you're in a battle in the Republican primary to get the nomination and go against a Democrat. And I guess the biggest name would be Keisha Bottoms, the mayor of Atlanta, the former mayor of Atlanta. So your thoughts about, you got the president's endorsement. Is that going to be enough?
Well, yeah, obviously very excited about President endorsing our candidacy. Obviously, he was down here a few weeks ago, and I campaigned with him for the Congressional 14th, which his candidate won that race as well. So obviously the president's got big approval ratings down here. So we're gonna take on these primary opponents we have, and then we'll take on whoever the Democrats have to offer. But I'd much rather have Trump's endorsement than anything else.
So you got billionaire Rick Jackson, who filed to run for governor, and he's a big supporter of President Trump, too. He's kind of neck and neck, and he's leading in a couple of polls, and you're leading in a couple of polls. What kind of opponent is billionaire Rick Jackson?
Well, he's not a very honest opponent. He's actually always been a longtime never-Trumper. He bankrolled Jeb Bush, Nikki Haley. He gave money to Liz Cheney. The list goes on and on and on. So he's trying to act like he's a Trump-like candidate, but he's never been with the president, and I think the president knows that. So, but at any rate, and I think the voters will see that too, because he's throwing a lot of mud and he's spending a lot of money. But at the end of the day, I think people in Georgia are smarter than to fall for his tricks.
Well, I mean, he's leading in the coefficient poll, the quantum poll, I think that is. So that's two that he's up. Does that concern you?
In the Emerson poll, we were up. So obviously poll numbers, you know, when especially when his team is the one behind them, they can you can fudge them to make them look however you want to. We're winning every straw poll that we're going to. We're going, you know, to districts and congressional districts and county seats. You know, we're drawing a couple hundred folks and they'll do straw polls and we're winning every one of those. So I believe the grassroots is with us and our ground game is better. And obviously, like I said, we're exposing him for what he really is, and that's somebody who has you know, benefited off a lot of state and federal contracts, and he's made his money by being the ultimate insider by paying off politicians, and he's tried to act like he's an outsider. So we're going to run our race on lowering taxes and the accomplishments that we've done, get rid of regulation, and obviously being the Trump endorsing candidate.
Yeah, I guess so. And what do you learn from working with Brian Kemp, the governor?
We've had a great working relationship. I tell people all the time, at one time, I might have been the only person that actually had an open dialogue with both President Trump and Governor Kemp. We've gotten a lot of things accomplished in the last 4 years that I've been lieutenant governor and with Governor Kemp. And, you know, he's a very popular governor and he's done a good job. And so I'm proud to have worked with him and want to continue to see Georgia do very well, and that's why I'm running.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of people are focusing on that Senate race too. Do you also agree that John Ossoff is one of the most vulnerable senators in the country?
Absolutely, especially with what he's doing here recently with this TSA thing. When we've got the busiest airport in the world here in Atlanta, and the lines are we've got 40% of the TSA.
Do you have a 4-hour wait in some cases?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. You know, 4-hour wait. We've got spring break that are starting for a lot of high schools and colleges here in the state of Georgia. We got the masters coming up here. So obviously the backlog is, you know, all he's doing is hurting Georgians. All he's doing is hurting his constituents right now by not, you know, instead of playing politics, by not doing the right thing. And that's funding these agents. And thank goodness for President Trump and sending in ICE, because no telling where the backlog would be right now. But people are starting to get angry. You know, we got a lot of good Southern hospitality down here, Brian, but there's just so much goodwill you can give when time and money is being wasted because of silly politics.
So Cory Booker, who's got a book out now and fancies himself a presidential candidate, is coming to Atlanta because he says it's a key political battleground because he wants to make sure they keep this seat and maybe grab the Senate. Are you worried about Cory Booker's presence in town?
No, I'm not worried about Cory Booker's presence. I would welcome his presence because I can assure you nobody takes him serious down here. But he represents the National Democratic Party. It's a complete clown show wherever Cory goes. So if he wants to come down here and thinks he can help out whatever candidate, he's one of those you welcome somebody like him to come because it puts a picture on about where there is the National Democratic stand on issues.
Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, our guest. Lieutenant Governor, we know the war in Iran continues, going to be at least in a couple of more weeks. It's forcing gas prices up. I think 72%, according to a Fox poll, of Republicans support it, but independents, he's underwater. How does that affect? Because we know that you guys are a purple state in many ways. So how does that affect what you do, and how do you feel about this battle we're in?
Well, we're actually still a red-leaning state. You know, every one of our constitutional officers are Republican. We had big wins in 24 and 22, with the exception of those Senate races. But obviously, you know, at the end of the day, the economy is always, kitchen table issues is always going to be at the forefront. And when people are hurting in their wallets and pocketbooks, then they're going to take out their frustrations on the elected officials, quite frankly. So obviously, we're hoping, the reason why we suspend the gas tax was to try to give some relief. We think that the prices, I think the prices will come down, you know, here in the coming weeks, obviously. But anytime there's a disruption in Middle East, it doesn't matter what's going on. When there's a disruption, the gas prices usually go up.
And so many people do serve in Georgia, so you certainly feel that too. Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, who wants to be the next governor and get that Republican nomination first. Best of luck. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, Bob. Burt Jones. Back in a moment. Brian Kilmeade and Frank Siller.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, and let's bring in Frank Siller, CEO of Talented Towers. He's about to start a brand new campaign leading up to the 25-year mark since the 9/11 attacks. And let's bring him in now. Great to see you, Frank. Appreciate you Zooming with us. So I know before, to gain attention, you've walked for miles talking about Tunnel to Towers. This is going to be a little bit different. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah. So you're right. For the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I walked from the Pentagon to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where Flight 93 went down, to ground zero. It took me 6 weeks. I did about 15 miles a day. I talked to you at least once or twice a week while I was doing that walk. Yeah, helped me. I remember I was walking up Snickers Mountain. I was talking to you. I said, but I wasn't snickering when I was walking up that mountain. So so that was completely different than what we're doing here. We have a piece of steel from the South Tower in ground zero. It's about 26 feet long. It weighs over 16,000 pounds. We built this beautiful exhibit truck that we're putting it on, and we're going to bring it to many different special places around America so people remember what happened 25 years ago, because this is going to be the 25th anniversary of, you know, of 9/11.
So it's going to be 10,500 miles, 35 stops, 21 states, culminating with the return to New York. But that's where it's going to start. It's going to start in Lower Manhattan. The public, it's going to be this, the Steel Across America tour stop. It's going to be in Staten Island, over by me, on Long Island, Lieutenant Michael Murphy Museum for the Navy SEALs. Flight 93, I've been there too. Flight 93 National Memorial. Going to go to the Naval Station in Norfolk, Virginia, which we have a great station out there. Let us do Good Village and Land O'Lakes. We've seen that, those commercials. Then you're going to go to an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. What's the significance of there?
Well, because that's the Boca School where President Bush, if you, everyone remembers the famous scene when Andy Card goes over and whispers it in his ear, that, you know, that the tower, that one of the towers was hit. So we're going back to that school, and hopefully we're going to have some of the students that were little kids then, are going to come back and be with us 25 years later. Everything we do, we want to have a meaningful, significant event. So, you know, every location we go, we're going to have a great remembrance. Every time we go, look, that's steel. Think of this, Brian. You know, we lost 2,977 lives on 9/11. Many of them, most of them were at ground zero. There was over 1,000 bodies that were never recovered. So that piece of steel has the soul of my brother and so many others in that piece of steel. And that's what it represents, a burial ground of those lives that were given that day, and most certainly first responders who ran into those buildings to save other people. I want Americans to be able to go up on this truck, which they're going to have access to this piece of steel. I want them to put their hands on that piece of steel. I want them to feel the loss of that day, the sacrifice that was made that day, and the sacrifice has been made ever since. And I want them to say a prayer. I want them with the hand on that to say a prayer, for all the families that were affected by 9/11 and those who have given their life ever since. And of course, a prayer for America, because I know it's 250 years and 9/11 was big part of those 250 years.
So, Frank, do we know how many people have lost through cancer, you know, related illnesses for 9/11?
Well, thousands, but, you know, we have over 1,000 first responders who have died of 9/11 illnesses since 9/11. And we're helping a lot of those families. Tunnel to Towers Foundation, look, so our first mission from the very beginning was simple, was to honor the sacrifice my brother made and the sacrifice that so many others made, and to never forget. And then we found out along the way that the best way to never forget is to do something, is to do something, to deliver something. And we are delivering mortgage-free homes. It'll be over 2,000, Brian.
Wow.
2,000 mortgage-free homes at the end of this year. We're doing 343 mortgage-free homes just in 2026. Why 343? You know why. That's the amount of firefighters that died on 9/11, and my brother was a firefighter. So everything we do is has to have some significance behind it. It has to have meaning behind it. No gimmicks. Something that is real. And, you know, we take care of these great heroes that continue sacrifice. I just, forgive me for going on, but.
No,
they, you know,
that's why you're here.
The sacrifice that it continues to be made. You know, we lost 13 service members already in Iran, the war against Iran. Of those 13, seven of them have young families left behind. This past week, I have spoken to all seven of those five widows and two widowers, and told them that we are going to pay off their mortgages. In one case, we're going to buy them a house because they don't have one. So, you know, the sacrifice that continuously is being made for our country and our communities, because I talked to two other widows of police officers that were killed over the last 2 weeks. And told them the same message. So they're going to stay in their home, in a mortgage-free home. The sacrifice is made is continuous. So the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has to be here forever, and we're building it that way.
No doubt about it. And I think also when you go around, a lot of people, it's not their fault. They weren't born when, you know, they were born after. So do you feel like you're educating at the same time?
100%. And we're going to have our mobile exhibit with many of these stops. So it's a 93-foot tractor trailer that opens up to a museum. So we're going to have a piece of steel that was ground down at Ground Zero. And we're going to have some artifacts and other firefighters and police officers that, you know, fought the battle at Ground Zero on that fateful day. So, yeah. We have also on our website, K-12, we have a curriculum where you can just download it. Go to t2t.org. You want to teach your kid, you want to teach your class, you want to teach your school, you want to teach your community. Right there, you can just download this the age-appropriate curriculum.
So, I mean, some of the other places you're going to stop at around Mount Rushmore, which is going to be awesome. You're going to be at the USS Arizona Memorial Gardens, the Long Center for the Performing Arts. So it's going to be it's going to culminate on 9/11, right? And you'll be back in New York. I mean, this is an extensive. Are you going to be on all these stops?
So I'm going to be at many of the stops. I have my nephew, Stephen, my brother Stephen's youngest son, Stephen Jr., is going to be at a lot of them and a lot of family members. But look, think of this. We're starting, of course, at Ground Zero. That's how we're starting with the piece of steel there and heading to these many stops. But on September 9th, so recently I was at the White House. I was in the Oval Office with the president, and he wanted to know everything we're doing at the Tunnel to Towers. He's a big supporter of the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. And I was telling him everything we're doing, just I was telling you, we're going to do 343 homes. We got 2,000 families, you know, with mortgage-free homes and all the beautiful work that we took over 25,000 homeless veterans off the street. You know, we're buying all these hotels, remodeling them so these homeless veterans have a permanent place to live, not from one place to another. The program we have is incredible. I'm telling them all that, but then I'm telling them about the steel. And I said, this is why I'm here. Because, you know, of course, every property goes to the White House looking for money. I'm not looking for money for government. I'll take whatever we could get to help these families. But I'm not looking for nothing to slow us up. But I told him about the steel that we're going to bring around America. He was so fascinated. I said, well, that's why I'm here, Mr. President. I would like if we could come on the South Lawn on September 9th, 2 days before we go through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel like my brother did, right? And have it on the South Lawn with you there. He reached right across the Resolute desk. He shaked my hand. He said, absolutely. He got his guys in there right away to start working on it. And wow. It's incredible. So we're going to be, that's the next to the last stop. Then we're coming up to New York, and myself and my family will be walking through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel early, early in the morning. And I'm sure I'll see you on Fox and Friends that morning.
Yeah, Frank, we're talking to Frank Siller, CEO of Tunnel to Towers and founder. But Frank, you've been through so many mayors, and you've been through the pandemic when they told you don't do anything. And you're like, well, I'm doing something. You and I are going to have a ceremony. You, Tunnel to Towers, went and did a ceremony, announced the names and everything. What is your coordination with this mayor like? Do they understand that this is not something to be trifled with?
Well, we have permits and everything already, so we're blessed. The police department, the fire department, and people love Tunnel to Towers. It's very smooth. We have no pushback whatsoever. That's for sure. And, you know, if we did have pushback, you know how I would address it. So thank God that we don't have, and everybody is on board to remember what happened 25 years ago. I won't say everybody, but the people who love America.
No, I understand. If people want to give, especially to this tour, is there a way to do it?
Well, yes. So you go to t2t.org. You donate $11 a month. You know what we've been doing for all these years. It's a remarkable. Yeah. I have Home Depot, General Motors, American Express, T-Mobile, Budweiser. Yeah. You know, we have these great, these great companies that help us. But I count on $11 a month, Brian. I count on $11 a month. And we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who do that. And that's how we keep our promise to build all these mortgage-free homes for catastrophically injured service members or first responders, or pay off mortgages for Gold Star families and first responders who die in the line of duty and leave young families behind. But last but not least, and you don't even know this, that a couple of weeks ago we made an announcement, and I'll be coming on Fox and Friends shortly, I'm sure, to talk about it, that we are going to make sure that each one of these kids that are left behind have a free tuition for college education. Wow. So it's the May and George Silla Scholarship, named after my mom and dad, who were two remarkable human beings, the most spiritual people you'd want to meet, to put their seven kids on a course to doing good, to take care of, to serve and serve others, but most certainly put their young Stephen, my brother Stephen, made the ultimate sacrifice by giving his life.
Wow, that is awesome. Frank Siller, thanks so much. Always on the move, always raising the bar, especially 25 years since the 9/11 attacks. Thanks so much, Frank. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
He's also a very valuable member of our show, because he allows us to do the Tunnel to Towers update every single day that you could get online. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll be back. We'll take some of your calls, 1-866-408-7669. I'll read your emails at briankilmeade.com. The President of the United States is still having his cabinet meeting. If he make news, we'll bring it back.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
They are begging to make a deal, not me. They're begging to make a deal. And anybody that saw what was happening over there would understand why they want to make a deal. But they say, oh, we're not talking to them. Anybody would know that. And only a total fool. And they're not fools. They're very smart, actually, in a certain way. And they're great negotiators. I say they're lousy fighters, but they're great negotiators. They are begging to work out a deal.
So that's the President of the United States now taking questions from the press with his full cabinet in attendance, so you can get any question answered. He's given plenty of time, and he just was commenting that Iran is wanting to make a deal, and then little by little they're losing the ability to conduct warfare, and not happening quick enough for some, but he's going to need a couple more weeks, just basically cutting them down to size every single day. But the question is, for how long, and can you sustain it? And what they are doing is now charging about $2 million for any barge to go through there, and Pakistan might have paid it. So I asked everyone to write, and a lot of people are writing about Mark Wayne Mullen. Brian, thanks very much for backing up Mark Wayne Mullen, your defense of him. Just a caution to call him Mullen, not Mullins, and nothing wrong with being a plumber. I 100% agree with that, and that is really the point. Mark Thiessen's comments. Mark claimed Donald Trump knows his enemies. Very conveniently omits to mention the Democratic one, Vladimir Putin, in his equations. True. I think the president's way too easy on Vladimir Putin. I agree with you. I didn't bring it up. That could have been my fault. But I wanted to talk more about what's happening in this region. But I have no respect for Putin. Zero. And I hate the fact that for temporarily, just to keep the oil price down for the country, for the world, we're allowing them to sell oil. But it'll go right back, snap right back as soon as this is done. So there's no doubt about it. That's true. Talking about the TSA, Culberson writes, I'm listening to you this morning. I have done research in this. You cannot give cash to the TSA agents because it's perceived as a bribe. That's true. What I thought, and I got this email from one of our listeners, and they said, I have a good idea. Why, if everyone goes through, gives them a dollar, they'll be able to make their money and get paid when everything gets funded again. But it turns out it's illegal. That's what Chris Sununu was telling me off camera. You're not allowed to give an agent any money or a tip or anything like that. They're not allowed to accept it if you do, in fact, give it to them. All right. It was just an idea. I just want to find some way to get their money. Also, that's part of the reason the offer from Elon Musk was not accepted. Evidently, you're not allowed to pay federal workers when they're on the payroll. David writes me and says, Brian, love your show. On gas prices, under President Biden, prices reached $5 a gallon in 2022. AAA confirmed it. Trump lowered those prices from the minute he took office. Yes, the Iran conflict is impacting oil prices, but look how much money Americans have saved by having Trump in there. Yes, and they got to go back down quick. I hear that's not going to be as quick as the president wants, but it is going to go down quick. I think that's a very important point to point out. But I thought it was also good. The UAE Minister of State for the UAE said this about Iran. Cut 11.
We have now seen Iran take the irresponsible decision, instead of negotiating with the United States over really well-understood concerns over its nuclear program, over its ballistic missiles program, over its support of non-state terrorist actors in the region. Instead of negotiating over those issues, they chose instead to fire over 2,200 missiles and drones at the United Arab Emirates, a peacemaker in the region, a country that signed the Abraham Accords 5 years ago, a country that has tried to extend the hand of peace to Iran, a country that has tried to push for negotiations and dialogue. So the question is why? And I think the answer is because we are an idea that threatens Iran, that threatens this regime, because we are open, we are progressive, we are tolerant, we're a vibrant economy. And what have they done for their people with the resources that they have? They sit across three continents just the same way we do. They have inflation. Their currency is in free fall. They had a spate of killing protesters in January. This is a really ruthless regime. And President Trump is right to hold it to account today.
I mean, you think you're talking to a NATO ally. And I guess they're affiliated with NATO in some way, shape, or form. But this is not something the prime minister of the UK is saying. It's not something President Macron is saying. It's not something the chancellor is saying of Germany. But this is something this is a country that's being targeted that has every reason to say, look, I'm about to invest $1.4 trillion into your country. I need you to level off here. You know, we're getting killed here. That sense of serenity and of being a paradise is being punctured. No, they say no. Just whatever you do. Don't leave them wounded. Knock them out. Saudi Arabia, the same thing. Oman is a different take, but Oman should keep this in mind. And I know nothing about the nature of these countries, and I have not been there. I don't, and we're probably never going to go there. But Oman says, hey, we were doing negotiating, and now you're aiming at me. Yes, exactly. The country you were counting on to broker peace, you're now shelling. That's what Iran is. By the way, go to BrianKilmeade.com, and this way I could see you in person. Got some great events coming up, including at Westbury Music Fair on Long Island coming up October. Coming up next in Reno, Nevada, May 30th. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets.